You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Anybody here today? Just to show you around, this is what the smaller units are like.
George Montgomery owns and operates a boutique co-working space in Culver City called Procolo. It's on Washington Boulevard, just northeast of the city's downtown area. He rents space to small businesses and creatives.
And a little cozier, three companies, maybe 15 people total.
Like most folks in the office space industry, Montgomery's business took a major blow at the height of the pandemic.
It was a pretty extensive period that you couldn't legally have anyone here, which it just, we were stuck in that spot of there's no way to really pivot.
And just as his business began to recover, enter the new COVID strains, Delta, Omicron. Will anyone want to leave their house to work here in the future? And if there's no going back to the old normal, what happens to all these offices? KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb joins us now with more. He covers the business of Southern California. Hey, Benjamin.
Hey there, Steve.
Why don't we start with a reminder about what's happening with in-person office work right now in LA?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So it really depends, Steve, on the business. You certainly have offices that have returned fully to in-person work, but the LA County Health guidelines for doing this safely, well, they're extensive. I mean, it's a massive list. You've got everything from mandatory masking. Also, there's what's considered a proper mask. There are vaccine guidelines, ventilation upgrades. It goes on, and the list, it changes constantly. Lots of other offices have not come back together in person at all or are doing hybrid work too, and that's pushing their return back as well. And by the way, Steve, that includes our office space.
Yeah, that does include our office space because right now you and I are talking from our own home offices, right? I'm in the corner of my living room.
Yeah, and I'm in my home office. We sure are. But there's something different about this year, 2022, compared to the last 2 years of this pandemic. For many businesses that have employees in offices, the pandemic was first seen as having a short-term impact, that things would hopefully return back to how they were before at some point, but that's no longer true, according to Spencer Levy. He's with the commercial real estate firm CBRE, and he says workers have a lot of power right now.
And one of the most tangible ways they're asserting those rights is we want more hybrid work, we want more work from home, and we want the workplace to be someplace we want to go, not need to go.
Want to go. So that brings us back to folks like George Montgomery, right? Whose livelihood is based on folks working together in person. Now, this is a big part of Culver City's economy right now, isn't it, Benjamin? Didn't Apple and HBO just build new offices there?
It's very true, and it's certainly a concern for Culver City and its immediate future, according to Thomas O'Hara Small. He's the former mayor of Culver City and now the CEO of a nonprofit called Culver City Forward.
You know, the headquarters of Apple is right down the street here, and they have never occupied that building yet, and we expected that in January. Now they have postponed that. The same thing with Amazon Studios just a few blocks down. So, and there's definitely the feeling amongst the community. It's like, well, do we go back to dinner, go out to dinner? Probably not, you know, unless it's outdoors. But it feels like a dam that's going to burst, you know, hopefully in the next month or two.
That's the hope, right? In the next month or two, that dam will burst. But bigger companies, Steve, they're doing really well without in-person work right now. So there's not really a hurry. Now, as for Montgomery and his boutique co-working space, he says he's banking on new small businesses to help him pay his bills.
Businesses that are just starting out, they don't have a lot of resources. You know, they can't get bank financing, they can't get venture capital, you know, but they might have a great idea or service that they can provide. I think we really pride ourselves on being there to kind of support businesses like that. And that's who's coming now, is that people really want to engage in person.
Does George Montgomery have tenants right now, Benjamin?
He does, though it certainly was not packed the day that I visited. I should mention it was a Friday, but it wasn't packed. Even so, there are people who want to be in offices, and Montgomery's found some of them. One of his tenants is named Greg Jamrock, and he told me why.
Well, I'm actually part of the Great Resignation, so I worked at a company for 15 years.
His new company, Fine Line Music Service, writes orchestral music for feature films and TV. Some of the recent projects include the Disney Plus series, The Book of Boba Fett, also Star Trek Day on Paramount Plus. Now, he says he prefers this co-work environment with a kitchen, a bathroom, and a shower, and above all, flexible workspaces.
My previous office was sort of like the college dorm version. And it was very oppressive psychologically. Everybody was crammed into a little space. And it really makes a big difference psychologically.
Now, he did add that his clients just aren't ready to come visit him at his home office. So he feels more comfortable having people at this co-working space. That's at least one arrow in the pro office quiver, Steve.
The pro office quiver. Well, I want to look ahead, Benjamin, because, you know, businesses, they thrive on planning, and this pandemic makes that so difficult. We've got a number of businesses right now in Los Angeles that are limiting in-person work if they can, many through the rest of this month, if not longer. How might that reshape places like Culver City, which, I mean, it's seen a real business boom in recent years, hasn't it?
Well, I asked George Montgomery about that, and he recommended that the two of us take a drive over to Hayden Tract. If you've never been there before, this used to be an industrial zone that's been revitalized to host all sorts of creative companies, from software to studios. You've got the mobile gaming company Scopely. There's also Wildcard Media there.
You saw coming into the parking lot, everything looks fine. As you pull in, there's everyone's got the prime parking down there, but this is normally completely full, this structure. And this company here, you can look in there and literally all their stuff from March of 2020 is there, and there's nobody working there.
It was kind of like a pandemic museum, Steve. He was pointing to the ad agency Omelet, which has offices here. And this place, it looks like LA on Thanksgiving Friday, right? There was nobody there.
Nobody there. And you remember those disaster movies where you see the clock stopped at the point of, you know, whatever it was, the earthquake or the hurricane. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So if folks, Benjamin, aren't going back to the office, what about repurposing those kinds of spaces for, say, housing? I mean, that's something that we need in LA, right?
There's no question about that, but that's a big maybe. I mean, conceptually, it makes perfect sense, right? I mean, these places are empty. We have a housing supply crisis. Why not? But Montgomery reminded me that it's not always so easy to just turn an abandoned office into apartments.
It's expensive to convert these into residential, so it's tough to figure out who does that and how it's done. Plumbing being probably the biggest issue. You know, there's not necessarily 20 places to put a kitchen or a bathroom.
Now, he did admit it is cheaper than building new housing from the ground up. And I should also say Montgomery's office space used to be housing. So yeah, it's not inconceivable. And there are investors that are looking into this possibility right now.
All right. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, who covers the business of Southern California for us. Benjamin, as always, thanks.
Anytime.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Mallory Smith wrote, produced, and reported a story for KCRW nearly 9 years ago when she was interning at this radio station.
Off the coast of Palos Verdes, there was once a flourishing marine ecosystem. A forest of kelp was the foundation, providing hundreds of marine species with food and shelter.
By her late teens and early 20s, Mallory had already become fascinated with the sea. And why wouldn't she be? That salty water actually helped her body manage what the disease, cystic fibrosis, was doing to it as a young child and into adulthood. More on that a little bit later. Mallory lived to be 25 years old. She died so young, heartbreakingly, in 2017, but not before she'd written page after page of personal memoirs chronicling her short but incredibly ambitious life. writings that would be included in a book entitled Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life, published less than 2 years after her death. And now a new documentary of the same name premieres tomorrow at the Lemley Royal on L.A.'s West Side and on Apple TV next week. Diane Shader Smith is Mallory's mom, an advocate for cystic fibrosis patients, and she's been drawing attention to her daughter's story to help others. And she's with us right now. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you for having me.
It has been a few years, but I want to extend our condolences on your loss. Mallory spent a little time with us. She was so sweet and so talented, and from what we could tell, she really enjoyed her time with KCRW. Did she ever talk to you about it?
Oh, yes. She would come home every day very animated, sharing with me what she had done and where she had gone with her tape recorder, and then I read in more detail when I went through her journal.
And we're gonna get to that. You're going through her journal. I mean, there was a process to that, and I want to go way back. You were pregnant at the time when Mallory, it was age 3, I believe it was, right? When she was diagnosed with CF, cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
Why had you been clued in about the disease in the first place?
Well, I was 6 months pregnant with another baby, and all the doctors told me that I had to terminate because this baby had CF, and I didn't even know what that was. I'd heard CF, MD, MS. There were a lot of diseases, and I was young, and I didn't really know the difference between any of them. And then when they started to explain to me what it was, I said, I think my daughter has it, because she had a lot of the symptoms that they described. And the shocking part was that after telling me I had to terminate because of this diagnosis, then when they told me that my daughter had it, they said, oh, it's not so bad. It's much better than it used to be. And so it was a very challenging time to reconcile those two pictures of the same disease.
Yeah, that's quite a dichotomy.
Yeah, it was pretty devastating. And the reason I thought to test her was because when I was getting my hair cut a week after the termination, and I was just sitting in their chair crying, and the hairdresser said, why are you crying? And I said, well, I had to terminate this pregnancy, and I was so looking forward to having this baby girl. And then when she asked why, and I explained it, she said, oh, I have a client who has CF. And I said, when was she diagnosed? And they said age 6, and that was the clue. Because Mallory had a lot of symptoms, and they used to send her home from preschool all the time. But I had an intuition at that moment that she had it, and I just raced off to the doctor to get her tested.
Mallory died, as I mentioned, at the age of 25. She'd had a lung transplant in September of 2017, but a superbug infection that had enveloped her old lungs had spread elsewhere. This is where new virus concocting therapies, they're called bacteriophage, right? Or
yes.
Phage,
yes,
for short. They're being developed to help fight off those superbugs. Did that experimental treatment, number one, did Mallory have, she had it, right? But it
yes.
was very early on.
So she got it at the end of her life. What happened was towards the end, when Mallory's lungs were really declining at a very steep pace, you know, rapidly, my husband, Mark, was very worried, and he started looking into research, and he saw that pig's lungs was an area that was being worked on. And he reached out to a doctor at Harvard named George Church, and he asked him about pig's lungs. And he said, that will not be here in time to save your daughter, but you should look into phage therapy. So Mark started reading about it, and he got in touch with Stephanie Strathy, an epidemiologist who, her husband was perfectly healthy. They had taken a trip to a third world country, and they came back, and he ended up on a ventilator with a superbug that he contracted abroad. And he was at death's door. They had nothing was working because the bacteria that he had picked up was so resistant. And she treated him with phage therapy and she saved him. But she never really got a lot of publicity for it. And it didn't get any traction. And in 2016, Mark started asking doctor after doctor after doctor at lots of different hospitals. And either they hadn't known about it or they said no to trying it if they did know about it. And it wasn't until we were at UPMC about 3 weeks before the end where Dr. Joe Paluski, the doctor that was taking care of Mallory in Pittsburgh, he said, sure, why not? We'll try it. And it was sort of a worldwide search to get this phage therapy for Mallory, and it did get there, and she was given the first dose, and she made history because she was the first patient with cystic fibrosis in the United States to receive phage therapy. But then the next morning, Dr. Paluski said it had been too long, and he felt that she was, you know, had no brain activity, and they made the you know, they gave us the advice to remove life support, and it was absolutely terrifying and awful, and we didn't want to do it, and we kept begging for relief, but they said it wasn't going to happen. And so then we asked for an autopsy, and the United States Navy worked on the autopsy, and they told us that the phages had started to work. They had reached their targets in Mallory's body and were doing what they were supposed to do. She just didn't get them in time, and that's what sparked all of the work we've been doing since then. And Mallory's story has enabled us to raise money and raise awareness. And I've been doing it, this is now 4 years.
You mentioned in the film that Mallory had written down and typed out so much over the years, chronicling what she was going through. And I want to play a clip because it's so powerful. This is you in the documentary.
When we moved to Pittsburgh for the transplant and she was afraid she might not make it, Mallory finally gave me the password to her journal and told me not to read it if she made it through transplant, but that if something happened to her, she wanted me to open it and there would be instructions inside.
How difficult, Diane, was it for you to look through all those things after she died? I mean, I can't even imagine after having gone through all of that.
Well, the journal is such a pivotal part of our lives because the whole time she was in high school and she was writing in it, every time she would go out, I would try to sneak a peek at it, but it was somehow password protected and locked into her computer and I couldn't even find it. I don't know where she hid it or what she named it as. But I could never find it, and I kept trying to break into it. And then the irony was, at the end, when she gave it to me, I was like, I don't want this because I don't like what it means. But she was, you know, she had all these calls to transplant. It was the fourth one that finally worked. But she was worried that she would die on the table and not have given it to me. So she gave me the password. And then after she passed away, I opened it on the day of her memorial because at that point I was thinking, well, maybe I'll look for something. And I didn't know what I was going to find. And what the journal ended up being to me was my grief therapy. For about 4 months, every single day, for 2 or 3 hours a day, I would hole up in my bedroom and I would just read and cry and read and cry. And I would relive the parts that I knew about. I was with her all the time. So I knew all the logistics and details and plans that she'd had, but a lot of the emotional undercurrent that she had experienced and the darkness that she didn't really ever share because she chose to live happy was revealed to me in her writing. And so I really went on a journey of discovery for about 4 months. And at the end, I knew exactly what to do. And that's how the book came to be. And I went to Richard Abadi and Claire Wachtel were the people that helped bring this to publication. And Random House, they normally take 18 to 24 months. And I said to them, it's a deal breaker. I will self-publish because I knew that her words were important and would help people, and I also knew that phage therapy needed to be announced to the world, and we needed to put pressure on the medical system to fund these trials, and we also have to raise money for compassionate use because nobody wants to pay for them. And so that's one of the things we're doing with all the profits. We're donating 100% from the book and the film.
Well, the documentary is called Salt in My Soul, The Art of Dying, which premieres tomorrow at the Lemley Royal on LA's West Side. It also premieres on Apple TV and Amazon next week. As you heard Diane saying, the proceeds are going towards cystic fibrosis research and those phage therapies. Diane Shader-Smith, the mother of our former intern, Mallory Smith, thank you so much for your time. And again, our condolences to you.
Thank you.
For KCRW, I'm Mallory Smith.
Well, from one sad but hopefully uplifting story to another now. In Los Feliz, tucked into Vermont Avenue, a couple of blocks north of Hollywood Boulevard, is the Dresden Room, or just the Dresden as we know it. The plush lounge is, of course, best known as the house of Marty and Elaine.
What do you say, man?
You can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk.
That's Marty and Elaine, captured in the movie Swingers back in 1996, playing their much-beloved version of the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive. The sequin jumpsuited couple held court there for some 35 years pre-pandemic, playing their special quirky mix of jazz standards and jazzed-out pop tunes to an endless stream of adoring Angelinos, famous and otherwise. Well, you probably heard that we lost Marty Roberts this week. Loving testimonials are all over Twitter and Facebook, people remembering the great times that they had sipping a cocktail or two and enjoying the vibe with Marty and Elaine. And joining me right now is Elaine Roberts. Elaine, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. So am I.
How are you doing?
Not very well, I'm sorry to say. It's hard. It's a difficult time.
It's expected for sure, right?
Right.
Yeah. You were 16 years old when you met and married Marty. That is so young. Tell us about when you two first got together. What do you remember about that time?
I was looking for a drummer, and we had a job in Alhambra, but we never did do it because Marty got us a job on the Sunset Strip in a very fashionable nightclub. We dated for about three and a half months, and we got married.
At age 16, you were, how old was he?
30.
30. You started out in L.A. as jazz players, right? You played and recorded with a bunch of different jazz artists when you first got together in the 1970s. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we always were jazz artists all the way through. We just play everything because you have to be versatile in order to work.
Marty was a huge Sinatra fan, I understand.
Oh, he loved Frank Sinatra. He had every album Frank ever made.
Did y'all ever perform for him?
Yeah, he came in the club, and I was about to sing, and I saw him, and I just decided to just play the piano and not sing because I got shook. And then I was mad at myself for about 3 or 4 weeks. I was just really upset because I said, well, he isn't a god. Why didn't you sing, you idiot? And so when he came in 3 weeks later, you know, I just flipped into perform mode because I was mad at myself, and I sang better than I ever sang in my life. My voice was ringing off the wall, and he was just, he put his hands on the spinet, was looking in my eyes all through it. And when I finished, he walked around the room clapping and making everybody clap and saying, bravo, and he threw me a kiss, and everybody flipped. I said, oh, he threw you a kiss. You're a celebrity now. And so when he was leaving, I ran into him and I thanked him. It was an accident. I mean, the powder room was right by the back door. And we ran into each other. And I said, thank you for throwing me a kiss. I'm a big celebrity now. Kidding. And he said, I don't kid around about music. It's too important. I threw you a kiss because you earned it. And then he kissed me on the cheek and left.
Oh,
and
wow.
I told Marty, I'm not going to wash my cheek.
Wow. Yeah, what was Marty saying about that? I mean, you know, that old Blue Eyes came inside and watched y'all play.
He thought it was great, but then he had his turn the following week. Frank walked in, and the boss sits him in the front table right in front of Marty and says, he has your voice. Now you have to listen to Marty sing. And Marty said, boy, you're really putting me on the spot. And he got on the microphone and said, Mr. Sinatra, that's not my idea. My boss is being a little bit crazy here, but I hope you'll forgive it, the incident. And Frank was very nice about it.
Wow.
And Marty sang for him.
Where was this? Where did these...
Gene Autry Hotel in Palm Springs.
Tell us, Elaine, a little bit about Marty. What was Marty like? What made him so special to you?
Marty was a very outgoing person. He loved people. He just loved to... He was a people person. We checked into this complex, you know, in Palm Springs, because we didn't live there, but we were working there. And there were like 500 people there, at least. And he went down to use the pool. There were three pools. And I didn't go on the first day. I was exhausted. I came down on the second day, and everybody said, hi, Marty, Marty's here. Like, they already knew him in one day. Because that's the way he was. He was like a people magnet.
He was a drummer, and he also played bass, right?
Yeah, I taught him to play bass. Well, what happened was we were working and drums were too loud for some of the exclusive restaurants in L.A. So we had these opportunities and they wanted piano and bass because it's quiet for, you know, dining. And bass was my second instrument in college. So I taught him to play bass. We'd get home from work and I'd read piano parts and he'd read bass parts for an hour every night. And then after a while, when he was ready, we got our first job as a duo, and we were working steady as a duo for a long time. In fact, the first 20 years of the Dresden, it was just Marty and I. After that, we added a bass player because Marty's tendon was starting to hurt. Bass is a very physical instrument. You know, you have to really pull on those strings, and after a while, your tendons get tired.
There's a lot of bass in jazz, though, right?
Oh, yes. It's a foundation instrument.
Yeah.
It lays the carpet for the whole thing.
When you started doing the nightclub act at the Dresden back in the 80s, you branched out beyond jazz, though, started including some... Well, we heard Stayin' Alive, pop tunes as well.
Oh, we always did, because we were there to please people and we were there to fill requests. And we incorporated everything into our music, but it was basically, on the bottom line, we were still playing jazz, but it was in a different idiom.
You played so many years there at the Dresden. What are some of your favorite memories?
Sandra Bullock. I walked in and the manager said, Sandra Bullock was looking for you. And I said, oh, really? Is the president of the United States looking also? And he said, no, seriously. She's in the dining room with her friends. Say hello to her. And I walked by to get my coffee and I didn't even say hello to her. I just said, oh, boy, not going to bother her. And so I went and got the coffee, came back in my room, and she came in my room. Our lounge room, whatever it was. And she, I said, hi, I'm Elaine. I ran right into her. And she said, oh, I know exactly who you are. I brought all my friends in to hear you. And I said, well, I certainly know who you are. I said, I just watched you last night on my sleep tape. I have like three of my favorite movies on a tape, and I go to sleep to it. And she said, you do that, I do that. She was really cute. She was so sweet.
What's on your sleep tape? What are the movies that you put on your sleep tape?
Oh, just any of the movies that I really like. On her, I had While You Were Sleeping and Miss Congeniality on one of my sleep tapes, the one
you
I had
did.
Been watching the night before.
You and Marty, y'all were night owls, right? You're a night owl. You're somebody who stays up really, really late. I mean, obviously, for, you know, in the profession you're in. I read in the LA Times that you don't get up until, you know, the afternoon.
Yeah, about 2. Go to sleep about 4 or 5. It's hard to break that habit.
Oh, it sure is. I mean, did it feel like the two of you were kind of living in your own world?
Sometimes it did. We were pretty, the two of us were like a unit, and we didn't really need anything else. It was great. We, you know, we had friends and everything, but basically... the two of us were enough.
I don't want to ask you the what are you going to do now, Elaine, because I think, you know, it's so soon. But what do you want to do?
I can't really think of that because I haven't had much sleep. I just wake up after an hour of sleep and then I start crying and I'm trying to stop doing that. That's my goal for right now.
No.
I don't want to cry anymore. I know he wouldn't want me to.
No.
Besides, it makes your nose stuff up and it gives you a headache and your eyes swell up and it's really not very productive.
Did you know that this was coming? I mean, obviously...
We were hoping until the last minute that that wouldn't happen. We were hoping he'd make you went to remission and be okay, but it just didn't happen. But we were hoping till the last second.
That's what keeps us going, though, right? Hope.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I've spent many a night watching you and Marty at the Dresden, and It's a wonderful experience, and I will miss that. I will miss Marty, and I'm sending you thoughts and condolences and prayers to you. Elaine Roberts, half of Marty and Elaine, who held court for so many years over at the Dresden in Los Feliz. Thank you so much, Elaine, and again, our condolences to you.
Well, thank you.
You can tell by the way I use my walk. I'm a woman's man, no time to talk.
Hi, Grant.
Woman worn my best, kicked around since I was born. Now it's all right. It's okay. You may look the other way. You can try to understand. See a time, a face I made. Whether you
Godspeed, Elaine. You have a lot of folks thinking about you right now. That's it for us. We're online, kcrw.com/GLA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.